This is the Paper Planes podcast, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Finance is one of the most important mobilizers for social change. You know, how do you equip young people for a world of work, which we have largely no idea what it will look like? The common denominator of all that is often boys who haven't had the space to develop the emotional language.
Welcome to the Paper Planes podcast, episode number 57. 57? I went all Kiwi there for a moment. 57. Welcome to the show. It is the newly shiny branded Paper Planes podcast, formerly the Simon Dell Show. If you're listening in and you're thinking, hold on, what the hell am I listening to? Today, we have a gentleman on the podcast by the name of Hunter Johnson. And before you ask, we do ask him about his similarity between his name and Hunter S. Thompson. So his parents apparently do have a very good sense of humor. So that's good to hear. A few bits and pieces before we talk about Hunter. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Instagram, the Paper Plane, fly at paperplanes.co is our Instagram. A big shout out to Gilberto for the work he does on this show, cleaning things up when I'm sitting in cars that I shouldn't really be sitting in. The podcastboss.com.au if you're interested in starting your own podcast. And if you'd like to come and see what we do, then fly at paperplanes.co. We are digital consultants and agents or digital agency, whatever we are. Sometimes consultants, sometimes an agency. But come and find out what we do. We help with all aspects of your digital marketing or your business's digital transformance. That's not even a word, is it? Your digital. I must be drunk this morning. Your digital transformation is where I was trying to go with that. Hunter S. Thompson, he is our guest today. He is the CEO of something called The Man Cave. It is a preventative mental health and emotional intelligence organization for young men, their parents, and teachers. This guy has done a huge amount of work helping with youth leadership, emotional intelligence, and social entrepreneurship. He has been involved in numerous organizations, Young Social Pioneers, Innovation at Kids, Director of Innovation at Kids, all sorts of bits and pieces. He's done a lot of guest speaking and presenting. He's presented at the United Nations. That's kind of as good as it gets. The Government House, Sydney Opera House, all those kind of bits and pieces as well. He's been recognized in the 2018 Queen's Young Leader by Her Majesty the Queen. And Harry and Meghan have recognized him as well. This guy is pretty up there, and he's still young, and he's still got a lot of time ahead of him. So he is very, very interesting. We talk about his business, how he got to where he got to. We talk about emotional intelligence. We talk about social media and teenagers. A little bit different from our normal conversations about marketing business, but still absolutely vital that you listen to this one, and very interesting. So without further ado, let us jump in and hear from Hunter Johnson. So welcome to the show, Hunter Johnson. How are you?
I'm doing really well this morning, mate. Just came back from 2 days of running programs with young men. So feeling pretty alive and pretty connected to our work.
Cool. And I must say, you've got an awesome name. And I think people must kind of get that mixed up with Hunter S. Thompson as well sometimes. I'm sure you've had that in your life.
I have, but believe it or not, that was the inspiration from my parents, from what they tell me.
Wow.
I think. Yeah. I'm not sure if it's the fear and loathing in Las Vegas or just the name that they're attached to, but definitely an influence.
So I'm just going to get, right, let's just work this out. How old are you? When were you born?
I'm 27, so born in 91.
Right. Okay. So they may have been going through some stuff in the 70s and 80s, weren't they?
Yeah. Listen, yeah. My parents, they're bold, audacious characters, so I wouldn't put it past them.
Okay. All right. Interesting. So let's give everybody a bit of an overview of who you are. We've done that in the introduction to the show, but give us your sort of 60-second elevator pitch. And I know it's going to be hard to keep it 60 seconds because you do a lot, but we'll probably go into it in a little bit more detail as we go forward. So give us that elevator pitch.
Sure. So I am the CEO of a charity based in Melbourne called The Man Cave, which is a preventative mental health and emotional intelligence organization for young men, their parents and their teachers. Effectively, what we do is send in young, charismatic, highly trained male role models into high schools who create the space for young men to take off the mask that they wear every day and start to develop some emotional tools for themselves to be able to support their mates, but also to be able to support the people in their lives that they care about. We've worked with about 10,000 young people right across the country. We've done no direct marketing whatsoever in our 4 years of operation. We've had over 150 schools across the world come to us, including some pretty incredible global recognition from the Queen, Prince Harry, Meghan Markle in the last 8 months, which is a statement that I'd never thought I would say, but that really pushed us to the forefront globally in a world where masculinity is in a really, really interesting place.
Yes.
You know, for me personally, just fascinated by behavior change and why we do what we do, and also love the challenge of applying a business mindset to social problems. And I think right now, particularly for, you know, the generation that I've grown up in, we've got a pretty unique opportunity where doing well financially and doing good socially are no longer mutually exclusive. And I'm really passionate around working in the for-profit but also for-purpose sector.
Yeah. Look, I think there's obviously a huge amount to talk around. And what I want to do, you know, is talk around the emotional intelligence, you know, space, which is obviously something you do a lot of work with. But I kind of want to take a step back to where you started, because you obviously have a background in psychology, but it looks like a lot of your education was in the business space. So how did you get yourself into that? What sort of led you into you know, into those university subjects?
Yeah, I grew up. My dad's a psychologist, an incredible psychologist, has been in the space for a number of years. So I've grown up with him as a role model that's always encouraged me to kind of question things, be curious about the world, follow my values. And, you know, I tried to rebel against that for as long as possible before it eventually caught up with me. And then, you know, my mom is an entrepreneur, so she runs an ASX listed company. It's actually the second Australian business ever to list on the ASX with a female CEO and a female chair.
Wow. Okay.
You know, I've got two wonderful step parents as well, who've played a massive role in my life too. So, you know, it's funny, I mentioned I was a pretty cheeky and rebellious teenager. But after kind of getting out of the bubble that I grew up in and going traveling, experiencing the world, had a major injury on the footy field, which kind of shifted my trajectory a bit, I started studying business and psychology at university. So I went directly into what both my parents did. But to be honest, I really struggled at university. You know, I was the kid that would rock up and be like, oh, shit, we've got an exam today. And luckily, I had enough of a base level of social intelligence where I could kind of get my way through. And exactly to your point, I learned more from mentors, podcasts, you know, TED Talks, YouTube, books, and from lived experience of being, you know, in the jungle of running various businesses over the last 6 years to actually learn, you know, experientially how business in the world works.
When you say you were cheeky and rebellious, what's your definition of cheeky and rebellious? Because, you know, my 3-year-old's cheeky and rebellious, you know, and he just talks back to you, and, you know, and we've now got a teenager living in the house. But, you know, some people's definition of cheeky and rebellious is, you know, taking hardcore drugs and stealing cars. So where
do I fit on the
scale?
Spectrum?
Yeah.
I'm just going to be mindful if my mum's listening to this podcast or not.
Right.
No, you know, I'm very open about my past because I think it makes, you know, who I am today, and particularly in the line of work, working with boys and young men, it's important to be honest. But I was the kid that was, you know, sneaking out from home at, you know, age 14, 15, going to parties, drinking, smoking. But the best thing for me was actually my rugby. You know, I wanted to be a professional rugby player. So that kind of kept me pretty fit and healthy. But at the same time was, you know, going to parties, there'd, you know, be fights around, and somehow I'd find myself kind of breaking them up or in between them, all the way to, you know, I remember one year I think I was about 15, and I was on a daily report card at school, where after every lesson I had to take my, like, a little report card up to a teacher, and they had to mark me with a certain grade. You know, all my reports would say Hunter would be such a good leader if he just stopped talking and mobilizes into something a little more meaningful. And I think, you know, even in one year, I got 27 detentions, including a detention whilst actually on detention.
That's going again, some, because they're 27. There's not that many weeks in the school year, is there?
I know, it was tough. You know, and like I said, it was just, you know, it was me just kind of pushing the boundaries a bit. Like one of the classic stories with my best mate was, you know, I saw hot summer's day. I saw a fire extinguisher. I thought it'd be funny just to squirt him with the water fire extinguisher. Little did I know that it was actually the foam fire extinguisher, and it completely covered him. The whole corridor ended up just being completely up in smokes, and, you know, I got a Saturday detention and, you know, had to deal with mum. So, you know, but part of all of that I think is really important because, you know, I mentioned earlier I had a pretty serious broken leg that actually ended up being something called compartment syndrome, which is where the bone punctures in and it punctures the muscle, and ended up being a metal rod, 4 screws, 2 skin grafts, 2 blood transfusions. But the worst was, you know, there's a high chance that I wouldn't be able to run again. That was a big crucible moment for me where, you know, I got to kind of press refresh on my identity, and you know, very lucky to grow up in a family that encouraged me to always, you know, have a plan B. And that's where kind of I shifted my trajectory a bit and things really kicked off.
Do you, that's interesting about that plan B. Is that something you see? Is that something you sort of teach people these days in terms of having a plan B?
Well, I think, you know, we live in such a complex time. I think, you know, young people, the data behind this is that a young person right now will work up to 17 different jobs in their lifetime and have 5 different career changes. And, you know, how do you equip young people for a world of work, which we have largely no idea what it will look like?
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the automation of jobs, whether it's, you know, globalization, whether it's the casual workforce. And so I think for me, the art for a lot of these young people, if I'm speaking to them about careers, is actually to think like an entrepreneur, not necessarily to be one, but to pick up the attributes, the critical thinking, you know, the negotiation, the understanding of how things work, and then to apply that on their given context, whether that's starting a business or working inside of a business. Mm. And, you know, and also, you know, the way that in my context, professional sports working, you know, guys will probably get to in and around 30 and then they'll have to jump ship and, you know, find out who they are outside of the identity that they created for themselves in a professional sporting context.
It's interesting. It's interesting you bring up that concept of a plan B. I heard Tim Ferriss, I think he was interviewing Jim Collins, and, you know, Jim Collins.
Yeah, I listened to it.
I might be right and I might be wrong, whether it was them that they were talking about not having a plan B, about deliberately not having a plan B, because if you do have a plan B, that won't make you committed to plan A, if that makes sense. So, it may be that it wasn't Jim Collins that was saying that, but I definitely remember listening to that. So anyway. But yeah, that, I mean, that's interesting. So when you finish sort of university, and obviously through university, it's clear that you were kind of doing a lot of volunteering, you know, a lot of helping out. When day one university's finished, what were you sitting there thinking? What were your plans for that point?
It's an interesting question. I've actually got about three subjects to go from my business and psychology degree. I ended up deferring for about 6 years. It was originally going to be a six-month sabbatical working with Jan Owen down at the Foundation for Young Australians, who's an unbelievable leader who's made a massive impact on my life. And that 6 months very quickly turned into 6 years as I got thrown in the deep end of business, of facilitation, of partnerships, and program delivery. And through that was very fortunate to work with a number of organizations that were really working at the front line of social change. And the thing that particularly stood out to me was this real shift of the philanthropic sector, particularly the next generation of wealth inheritors, those under the age of 40 who will inherit a significant amount of wealth, their collaboration with entrepreneurs that have a social or an environmental purpose behind their business. The idea that if they connected and collaborated, that would fast-track social change quicker than any government or any corporation. And so that was kind of my the thing that seduced me out of my degree, which I was I felt like I was just treading water and was, you know, sitting in lectures which were 150 PowerPoint slides in a row with someone who didn't really want to be there delivering the information. So much to my my grandparents and particularly my mother's demise, I've still got a few subjects to go. And, you know, to be honest, with the way that education is moving globally and how fast we can gain access to information, I'm not sure if I will go back to complete it. I guess that kind of talks to the, you know, the first day out of university was really just a 6 month sabbatical, and here I am 6 years later, running, pretty fortunate to be running an incredible charity.
You also, I mean, you did some stuff with, you know, in asset management and that kind of thing. That sort of seemed like that was a bit of a 2 year stint. Was that sort of you going into there and going, right, well, I ought to do something proper with my business degree or my business background here, and then not really enjoying that? Or was, you know, is that something you're still interested in?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the obviously the finance is one of the most important mobilizers for social change. And for me, mentoring has played an incredibly important role, and I've been fortunate to work with and under some exceptional leaders who have really pushed me to the front to learn. And part of that is exposure to different financial markets and institutions. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, incredibly fascinated by the world of impact investing and social investment, where people can, you know, invest into a certain opportunity that will bring up not only a financial return, but one that has social or environmental benefits as well. So for me at that stage of my career, I kind of describe it as, you know, discovery mode, where I just said yes to a whole range of things and started to gain momentum in each of those areas. And as I started to discover where my unique strengths were, I would then say no to given opportunities until I could hyper-focus on where I was seeing the most return on investment for my time and my impact.
Okay. So let's talk about the man cave. And there's probably going to be there's three core sections I want to talk about here. The first one is the brand. When you sat down and you kind of went, right, I want to do something. How did you? Where did that come from? Was that sort of a, you know, a light bulb moment, or was that a work over time? And, you know, how did you come up with the name? Was it all done on the back of a, you know, a beer coaster in the pub? How did that all come about?
Yeah, it's you know, it's funny. I was working with an advertising agency recently, and we had to do a mini pitch. And one of the guys in the advertising agency said, "Are you sure it should be called the Man Cave?" And I'm like, "He's like, it doesn't really seem like that's what you guys do." And I just said to him, "Well, mate, if it was called the Feelings Cave, I don't reckon we'd be getting too many young men attending." And he's like, "Ah, yes, good point." You know, and I think within that, you know, the origin of it started when I was running an incubator program called Young Social Pioneers, which brings together the top social entrepreneurs under the age of 30. We bring them together all across Australia, pull apart their business models, put them back together and help them pitch to investors, philanthropists and funders. And whilst all that was going on, I was exposed to some pretty incredible people who were just inspiring to be around. on the other side, I'd grown up in a pretty hyper-masculine environment, which, you know, at times I loved, and just the boys' culture and being around the camaraderie, but also at times, you know, I felt pretty trapped by it. And often I didn't have the language to articulate that when I was younger, but as I got older, I recognized that a lot of my mates would open up, you know, to me or to other mates after, you know, they're a couple of beers deep or, you know, something tragic had happened, and then they'd open up for a bit and then shut down. And, you know, just using, you know, what I'd gained from my psychology degree, had seen that, you know, masculinity was in a pretty interesting position. You know, we know that 1 in 5 young people will experience anxiety or depression before they're 18. We also know that suicide is the leading cause of death for young men under the age of 25. We see one woman killed every week from a result of male perpetrated domestic violence. Yet a lot of the systems that we have, particularly in Australia, are focused around crisis management and band-aid solutions, and very little working at the preventative. And if you look at the common denominator of all that, it's often boys who haven't had the space to develop the emotional language, whether they've had the permission to develop that, or even the space in their life to open up and start talking about some of that stuff. And so there are a few, you know, men in my life who I'd seen struggle with depression, with violence, with addiction, and, you know, a few suicides as we grew up as well. And again, with my best mate at the time, we just thought this was largely preventable. So we would take days off our respective jobs about 5 years ago, drive out into the country and run a program for young boys, just giving them the space to open up. And from there, we, you know, after the first few weeks, we're like, geez, we probably should name this thing. What's a place that blokes, you know, end up going to? Just, you know, it's their space. And that's where the origin of the man cave came from.
I'm going to say it's probably that it was probably a nightmare trying to get a domain for that.
Yeah, well, it's funny. It's, you know, the website is themancave.life, L-I-F-E, and for, you know, .com.au.org was all taken. And it's funny, you type in man cave now, and it's pretty interesting, the results that originally came up. Fortunately, our brand has got growing pretty quickly now with an organic SEO. And so we do pop up there pretty quickly. But, you know, interesting what originally came up.
When you went and then sort of built that brand and everything, did you work with an ad agency there, or was that just was that a local designer? How did that all sort of come about?
Yeah, so we originally, it was from a friend of a friend who just helped us whip up a basic kind of brand kit and website. And then when things started to kind of gain a bit of momentum, I reached out to, again, another friend and said, do you know any agencies that would be interested in supporting us? We're a not-for-profit. And they said, yeah, listen, there's this organization who I think would be able to help you out. Can't promise anything. So I cold emailed them, set up a meeting in Collingwood, and walked into the most stunning offices, literally looked like MoMA in New York, and sat down, kind of shared why we do the work, the impact it's having, and what we're out to achieve. And the founder said, listen, love what you guys do. Like, what's your budget? And I gave him a very blank stare and put up the number 0. And he said, that's okay. And he pointed to the corner and said, see those two teenagers over there? I said, yes. He goes, they're our two kids. And, you know, this is our bit for making the world a better place for them. Yeah. So to this day, it's been an unbelievable digital studio called Raft Studio, who have been incredibly generous for us over the last, particularly the last 3 years of building our brand and our website. And, you know, we've just got an incredible relationship with them. So that's kind of the origins, and we love their work.
You mentioned you've not done any direct marketing. How did you grow? I mean, you know, word of mouth obviously has sustained you through the things you're doing, because everything you're doing is, you know, is fantastic, and people are obviously talking about you. But were there any other things that you've done to kind of get your name out there?
Yeah, I think for us, it's not around, you know, I guess the other distinction here is between branding and marketing. And for us, the brand component that came was from doing a really good job. And, you know, whilst we were building the Man Cave its original years, we were still working at our respective jobs, my founder and I. Then as it started to gain momentum, we started to tell really powerful stories to our close network on, you know, the various social media channels that we have. And then we started to get invited to do a lot of keynote talks as, you know, masculinity, as I mentioned, you know, in this period of flux where it's, you know, it's a really sensitive topic, but also not many people working preventative end. And in those original kind of keynote discussions, they again made an impact, which then brought us more leads, more leads and more leads. And then from there, you know, the media jumped on board. And since then, again, I put it down to the integrity of our work, the professionalism of our team, the fact that we tell powerful stories. And, you know, we really focus on relationship management. And for us, a very guiding principle is twofold. Relationship before transaction with anyone that we work with. And one of our organizational values is to leave it better than we found it. So that goes to with the schools that we work with, the young men, or the you know, the parents, the teachers that we also work with.
Do you think it's, apologies if this sounds like a criticism, but do you think it is sustainable for you to grow this and continue to grow this just on word of mouth alone? Or do you think you're going to need at some point to sort of go, you know what, we will need to invest something somewhere along the line in terms of from growth?
Yeah, I absolutely think so. And I think it's, you know, depending what the intention of the marketing is, if it's conversion of leads or if it's gaining reach and entering into public consciousness.
Yeah.
You know, and as we know, like with the everyone is on their phones or, you know, on social media. So how do we fight for the attention of the respective people who we want to influence?
Yeah.
And, you know, for us, it's twofold, right? Because we're an organization that exists to serve young men. However, the key decision makers of those young men are their parents, their teachers, their principals, et cetera. So it's an interesting nuance in our communication. But to your question, I definitely think we will be moving to that point in time. We have a very strong organic lead flow that comes through. And for us as well, you know, we're not after necessarily a vanity metric of working with, you know, a million young men by this date. We're actually more focused on impact first and working with communities to have multiple touch points and to empower that community, opposed to just scaling for scaling's sake.
Let's talk about the core things that you do. And I think probably the two things I want to tackle here, because hopefully people that are listening have, you know, understand the importance of these two things. And what I'd like to do is perhaps relate this to, I realize that a majority of the work that you do is with, you know, younger men and young men, but I'd like to think about this from a perspective of a male business owner, a male leader, someone who's kind of under that pressure every day, you know, might have a small company, might have a big company, whatever it is. And the two areas I want to ask you about is, number one, to help people understand what the concept of emotional intelligence is. And the second thing is to understand how to deal with teenagers and social media, which is two completely different questions. So let's concentrate on the emotional intelligence ones first. What's your definition of emotional intelligence?
Yeah, I think the other thing which I'll just add to kind of give this a premise is, like, we don't prescribed to be parenting experts, but what we can be is an insight and be the conduit into the lives of young men. And I think, you know, we work at a very interesting intersection where we're in schools, where we get the language and the world of these young men, but also can speak the language of their, you know, their key decision makers in their lives. So that's, I think that's an important distinction to make. For me personally, you know, the emotional intelligence is obviously a buzzword that goes around, but in simple terms, it's, you know, it's the capacity to be aware of and control and express our emotions and to be able to read social situations, to be able to self-regulate ourselves and decide with a level of self-awareness how we're feeling and how we want to engage with a context in front of us. And, you know, there's a classic quote from Daniel Goleman who talks about a lot of CEOs are hired on their IQ, but actually fired for their EQ. And, you know, with the changing working conditions, we've definitely seen a shift where leaders need to step into, you know, the buzzwords that we hear all around being more vulnerable, being more authentic, being more genuine. And I think the certain models of working context, which were very hierarchical, and if you look at the kind of developmental psychology and also the organizational psychology that has led us to this point in time, often our working structures have been a direct reflection of our society's consciousness. And now we're in a very interesting time where organizations are much more flatter, it's much more trust, much more nimble, which requires leaders to be able to be much more emotionally and socially aware and available for their employees.
Give me, you mentioned Daniel Goleman there, that his book, Emotional Intelligence, I bought probably 6 months ago, and it's still sitting in my to-read pile, which is an ever-growing pile of business books and science fiction and that kind of thing. And you know, for everyone who you know, I bought it simply because you know I'd seen it recommended in so many different places. I presume you've read that, and you know, would recommend that to people.
Yeah, I think it's you know, it's a great work. I think the original book actually came out in 1991 from Goleman, so it's definitely been around for a number of years. I think my memory might fade me here, but the two pioneering actual researchers before that was a guy called Salovey and a guy called Mayer. And then Daniel Goleman kind of took that to the mainstream. There's obviously a vast array of books on EQ and dealing with emotions. And also, you know, a number of courses that around the personal development world that, fit into that. I think it's worthwhile for anything, if you're interested in the space, to start with a book like that, just to give you the foundational knowledge. But to your point, I'm very mindful that everyone's reading lists and podcast list is radically exploding. And, you know, in regards to Tim Ferriss that we mentioned earlier, one of the things that he mentioned which really resonates with me is instead of just in case reading, you know, where you're like, oh, I'll get that book just in case I ever need that knowledge, actually flipping that to just in time reading.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you need it, it's relevant, you're in it, it's emotionally charged for you. So you devour that book because you need it at that moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's a pretty simple thing that I definitely use for my reading at the moment.
I gave up on a book. A couple of days ago. It was Neil deGrasse Tyson's it was basically Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, I think is the title. And I'm a big science fiction nerd, so I kind of went, you know, and I write a lot of science fiction, so I kind of went, you know what, I ought to know more about astrophysics. And I got a third of the way and I went, you know what, I just don't care about astrophysics.
And it's like, there's a guilt in there, right? There's a moral guilt. You're like, should I just finish this? And it's like, actually no.
I think there's a lot of people guilt themselves into sitting through books and films and TV shows that they don't.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm, as I say, science fiction and end of the world stuff, that's where I kind of get really excited. But even I've given up on The Walking Dead now. I'm just like, you know what? I don't care. I don't care what happens to these people or the zombies or anything. Yeah. Just, no, I've got better things to do with my time. But
that's good. That's good.
Interestingly, I then jumped into, which I am enjoying much more and I will finish, is Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, which I've been told to read by many people. And I'm only sort of three or four chapters in, but yeah, that's good so far. So,
Nice. So
we talk about emotional intelligence. Give us some examples about if you're a business leader or if you're a business owner or that kind of thing, just some things that you would recommend that people can do to kind of improve that on just little things on a day-to-day basis.
Sure. So one of the things that we have brought into our organizational culture, which has been fundamentally incredible for our camaraderie, our morale, and just the buy-in from our staff, is a very simple tool called a check-in. So before every day, we get our staff to sit down in kind of smaller teams and check in for 2 minutes around how they're doing.
Right.
And the role is for literally the group to do just to sit there and just listen. And the person has, you know, the full 2 minutes if they just want to say whatever is going on in their mind. It will then move on to the next person, the next person, the next person. After that, the energy is
everyone completely drops into the space. We know that with vulnerability, it actually builds deeper connection and intimacy and loyalty. But also it allows our staff to bring their full self to work and recognize that we are human beings. There is stuff going on in our lives. And instead of us just kind of sitting away typing at our computer and not saying hello to each other in the morning, we actually bring much more of a deeper level of connection to kick off the day.
Yeah.
The second thing which we've actually introduced, which again has been very conducive of creating a high performance culture for us, is the notion of clearing. So each day after we do the check-in, we'll provide a space for our staff members to clear something. And that can be something like, hey, listen, I've got a couple of meetings today and I've got a call in one of those meetings. So I just want to bring that to your attention that I will need to duck out during this. Right. Another example of a clearing can be with a fellow staff member, where if there's something that's been nagging on, you know, our consciousness, where we can say, hey, listen, you know, Joel, you said you'd do this and actually you haven't done this and it's actually frustrating me. So I actually want to take responsibility for the fact that I haven't communicated this to you early enough. And going forward, I want to be in communication to check in with you to see if there's any support I can give you because I'm working towards a deadline.
Right.
And the powerful thing about that is that each person who makes the clearing takes responsibility for what's there for them to take responsibility for. It also creates a space where there's no morality, where people aren't good or bad or right or wrong or be shamed, but actually they can put everything on the table, they can name the unsaid, and we can collectively deal with it as a team.
Yeah. That's massively interesting. I mean, again, you probably would have heard this, but again, you may have read the book as well, but Ray Dalio's Principles, which he talks about radical transparency in his organization. Is that the sort of same thing or slightly different? Where's that kind of fit with that?
Yeah, I've read the book. I'm a big fan of Ray. You know, unfortunately, that we're a charity, so we don't have all the $180 billion worth of assets to instill the guiding principles. Yeah. that Ray has. But you know, that's definitely a, you know, it's been an influence because for us to be, you know, coming back to what we said at the beginning of this conversation, applying a business lens to some of the social problems means that we need to have a high performing culture. And, you know, the guys or the staff members that I have at my organization could all be working for, you know, the big four or some of the biggest marketing or agencies in the world. But I've managed to pull them from by their values to work for us and pay them a decent salary. And part of that is actually providing them, I believe it's my responsibility, of a personal and professional path of growth, which means working in a high-performance culture, which, you know, can be uncomfortable because being healthily challenged and feeling safe in that challenge can be uncomfortable, but we know the benefits on the other side when we reach those outcomes are definitely worth it.
Does that has to come from the top down, doesn't it? You can't, if you're in an organization where you go, you know what, I'd really like to tell the CEO what I think of him. you've kind of got to be in an organization that supports that.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if we don't, particularly working in an Australian context where we're very good at tall poppy syndrome, well, you know, we'll cut people down if they're any better. They think they're any better than us. And the other thing is, you know, I think fish rot from the head. Yeah. So if I'm not living, walking, breathing, role modeling these examples, then, you know, I'm a complete hypocrite. And, you know, I think particularly working in an organization that values emotional intelligence and hopefully lives it too, they're very quick to detect bullshit from me.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of my evolution as a leader is that I need to be accountable for that. And if that means owning and being responsible for the things that I haven't shown up in, then I'll completely do that.
Yeah,
it doesn't make it any easier, but it's the only thing that's going to continue to boost our momentum going forward.
Let's just touch on the other question that I had there about teenagers and social media. And again, I mean, I know we're slightly diverging off the whole business and marketing thing, but I think this is just such a challenging time for both social media and both teenagers. But specifically men in and social media. And it's interesting, I'll preface your response by something I read the other day that the Batuta advocate, who I'm sure you've read before, that bastion of truth and honesty out there. But they were making a joke about how Instagram had replaced for teenagers and tradies, or teenage boys and tradies around Australia, that Instagram had replaced Zoom magazine as the go-to place for, you know, girls in bikinis and things like that. Give us your kind of opinion on that. And I think I'm interested in understanding, for all the parents out there, they've got teenagers using social media, some of the things that you suggest and advise and observe.
Yeah, well, I think just to kind of premise that we've got a couple million-year-old brain that is suddenly dealing with, for teenagers, not only the pressures of wanting to belong and fit in with the tribe, of increased homework and schoolwork pressure. The education is continually leveling up for these young people. They now have more extracurricular activities than ever before. And the politics of being in a schoolyard environment, and if you flash back to being a teenager is about survival. you got to work out who you need to be, and you play those cards.
Yeah.
And, you put your mask on every day, you put your armor on, and then you just go. And if you're a teenage boy, chances are you're living in a culture of banter, where you're just shooting from the hip, very worried about someone finding out or you stepping out of the crowd and people identifying you for that.
Yeah.
And the really interesting thing about Australian culture is, I mentioned earlier, we've got tall poppy syndrome. So if anyone steps up and tries to be a leader, particularly with teenagers, they'll be cut down. And these kids who, I was with a school yesterday, and this kid was playing for Australia in like under 16 soccer.
Yeah.
And his mates were like, oh, he plays for Australia. And he's like, no, I don't. I'm like, mates, did you actually play for Australia? And he goes, no. His mate's like, yes, he does. He just doesn't want to admit it. I'm like, hey, this is really interesting. Let's talk about this. Because the reality is if we shy away from our unique gifts and talents, then we actually limit our ability to step into that potential. And actually, you have a choice how you show up in this. And more importantly, your mates have a choice how they celebrate you or they pull you down. And we had a beautiful conversation around what's the impact of living into this. Because we also know at the other end of the spectrum is if you're at the bottom of the food chain, you'll hear about it too.
Yeah.
So what that creates is a culture of mediocrity where people sit in the middle, particularly our teenagers, too scared to reach their potential. And, it's a similar thing. Like you put your hand up in class, and you get the answer wrong. What happens? Everyone laughs at you. What do you learn? Don't put your hand up in class.
Yeah.
And a lot of these, particularly these young men, don't question their social conditioning. And particularly that's what we do in our programs, give them the opportunity to step back and reflect on the rules that they've inherited, that they police each other on, that they validate each other on, and that they're conditioned by. And I think within a social media context, the fact that they now have this device with them, where the politics of the schoolyard come home with them on, whether it's Snapchat, and the pressures associated with a platform like Snapchat, where they have to continue what's called their streaks, it's the amount of times they can Snapchat someone in a row, and you have these kids that have like 6,000 day records. It's actually quite incredible. But also, it puts the pressure on them to continue using the device. We've got young people who are validating their self-worth and their identity based on the number of likes or followers they have or the notifications they're getting. And then there's the curating of this perfect lifestyle and image where, young people get FOMO, fear of missing out for not being somewhere. And so there's this continual pressure to fit in. And when you look again, coming back like to the teenage brain, it's emotionally developing, it's socially developing and growing, but it's also just wanting to fit in and survive.
Mm.
And by constantly feeling this need that I'm not a part of the group, all puts this unbelievable pressure on them. And we only need to look at these increasing rates of anxiety and depression to see the impact that it's having on them. The other really interesting thing in this is the role that addiction plays. We know that, young people are, what we call digital natives, for want of a better language. Yeah. And, there's a really fascinating book by an author called Johan Hari. He's written two books that have really stood out to me among a few others, but the first is Lost Connections and the second is Chasing the Scream. And Chasing the Scream is around addiction. And he talks about this experiment where they put a rat in an enclosure and they gave the rat two water options, one with a sterile water, the other laced with heroin. And they monitored the rat for 30 days to see what would happen. And as we can expect, the rat tests each water, eventually gets hooked on the heroin, and within 30 days becomes addicted and kills itself. And the conclusion that was drawn is heroin's addictive, it's a bad drug, we should outlaw it. As the experiment evolved, they realized that if they put more rats into that enclosure, and still had the two options of water and one interlaced with heroin, that no rat got addicted to the heroin. Right. So the camaraderie, the community and the connection that was experienced overpowered the addiction. Mm. And so you only need to look at how we've constructed our lives, but particularly for our young people, you know, or our classrooms, our bedrooms, our work offices, they are effectively a very, very similar environment to the same as those rats.
Yeah.
We know that these young people are more connected, more disconnected, but also more connected than ever before.
Yeah.
And on top of that, we're really lacking civic engagement. You know, it used to be, you know, you go to the town hall, you go to the church, the synagogue, the mosque, you know, the RSL club, somewhere where a community was thriving. Mm. Now a lot of people don't know their neighbors or we're scared or, you know, we're dissected from our families and our communities. And we know, particularly when young people are 12, 13, 14, they break away from their parents and they seek mentoring and guidance elsewhere to get those lessons. And that used to be from the village or the community, but now it's from Netflix. Now it's from Instagram. Now it's from Snapchat. Yeah. And this is the model and the belief system that they inherit. Mm. So that's the kind of bit of a landscape of the challenges that these young people face. And I think, you know, the most important thing that I've found is parents actually wanting to be friends with their kids opposed to being parents, I think is a really interesting distinction. I think we need to bring back parents who step powerfully into the parent role and don't have their children running their household.
Yeah.
The second is explaining the impact of their devices on them emotionally, how it impacts their brain, how it has a very similar effect with the serotonin and dopamine chemicals that get released to having crack cocaine. And also, you know, giving them a choice to co-create the rules, saying, you know, if this is going to work for you, how can we do this? And I'm going to lead this process as I'm the parent, but I want to make an agreement with you. Mm. And then if that trust is broken, using that as a teachable moment around how to rebuild trust in the home, but also in other relationships.
Fantastic. Fantastic advice. And to be honest with you, we could obviously talk about this all day, but I'm sure you've got other things to do today. a couple of other questions I want to just ask before we wind up. You've mentioned a few people, but I just want to get an idea about, and perhaps we can combine these into one, but the first question was people that you've met that really impress you and had an effect on you. And the second thing was books that you've read or you would recommend for people who want to find out more about this.
Yeah, wow. People, oh, geez, I've got a lot.
it's like you've got an Oscar speech here, you know. You didn't think you were going to win, Hunter, and you have, and now you've got to make a speech thanking all of them.
Well, you know, I got an amazing piece of advice from a mentor once around, you know, relationships and people, and he said it's not what you know, it's not who you know, it's who wakes up thinking about you. So how do you remain front of mind for, you know, key people in your life that really make an impact on your life? And I think that has definitely influenced how I think about this. You know, I've got a bit of recency bias. I caught up with an amazing friend last night, Yasmin Abdel Naguib, who is an incredible activist, you know, feminist, young Australian Muslim of the year who now lives over in London. She's made a massive impact on my life.
I think she's made a fair impact on quite a few people's lives in the last couple of years.
I agree. And you know what I respect outside of the drama that's ensued is the resilience that she's shown.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it's pretty inspiring, someone that holds their belief systems close to their heart. And someone who, you know, I've seen personally working on the front line with many young people, the impact that she's made. So Yasmin has been, an unbelievable role model for many young, particularly young women of colour. Jan Owen was a massive influence, the CEO of the Foundation for Young Australians. The chair of our Man Cave board, Ian Ward-Ambler, who is ex-Goldman Sachs, done a lot of work in violence against women and Indigenous land councils. And who else would I say? Someone, you know, my parents have been phenomenal. You know, my dad that's been a relationship that I've grown up into. And I think as I increasingly mature, I Exceptionally grateful for the moments of where I, as a teenage boy, tried to, you know, find problems with. But, you know, as I grow up, I've really just got the value and also how tough it is to be a parent. I've really got that. So, you know, and I love my mum dearly. She's obviously been an incredible role model for me too.
Yeah. What about are there some books that you just, you know, maybe one or two that you can recommend that we have? I mean, you've already mentioned a couple as we speak, but.
Yeah. Well, I think just to revisit, I think Principles is a phenomenal book.
Do you know, I'm sorry to interrupt you there. I hated that book. But that was one that I'll tell you why. Because I read it and I went, and this was one that I hated it pretty much every word I read all the way through. And I thought I should just stop and put it down. And I'm going, I can't, because I want to see if it gets better, or I want to see if I understand. And I'm the only person that I've ever met that didn't like it. And I think I didn't like it just because of Dalio's style, and not necessarily what he was saying, but I find the way that he writes to be intensely jarring. And that's maybe because I'm a writer myself. But anyway, I digress. Go on, keep going. Sorry.
No. It's interesting. I loved it. Yeah. So for me, it was like a bite-sized chunk where I could just dip into when I wanted. And I, you know, I the thing that fascinated me about that book was that it was consistently distilled down life lessons that have been tried and tested over time. Yeah. So for me, that was obviously a book, but I'm mindful that everyone also talks about that book. A massive book for me actually was a book called True North.
Okay.
Which is a book on authentic leadership, which takes you through a process, the content, and then there are certain self-awareness questions to answer around your own authentic leadership style. That was a fundamental book for me to kind of really set up who I am, what do I stand for, who inspires me, what is it about those people. I mentioned Lost Connections by Johan Hari, I think is absolutely non-negotiable reading for particularly parents, but also just for anyone who cares about, you know, mental health. And I actually just finished the Patagonia book, Let My People Go Surfing, which is obviously a $1 billion company, and they describe themselves as accidental billionaires. But, you know, the interesting thing for me in a world where startups are around, like, you know, getting that unicorn status or above as quick as possible. Yeah. Patagonia has been a business that's been in operation for 60, 70 years. And despite economic downturns, it's continued to thrive and use their status as one of the big companies in the world to be an activist for a better world. So, and they go through their marketing philosophy, their product philosophy, their individual organizational values, their distribution philosophy. And for me, you know, it just shows that the substantial truth, if you do it consistently over time, tends to win.
Fantastic. Last couple of questions. What's on the schedule for you for the rest of 2019? Anything sort of significant that's happening for you that you've got planned?
Yeah, the Man Cave, as I mentioned, is growing at a pretty incredible rate. So we're growing our team and really trying to find the scalable model to that increases the integrity, that keeps the integrity of the program whilst increases the quality of what we deliver to get to those communities across the world that need it most. So that's like a pretty core focus. We're also working on a new natural body care range for young men. It's kind of like Lynx, but with a social purpose. Yeah. And 50% of profits support the Man Cave in low socioeconomic communities. So we're at sample stage with that. We've brought on board some unbelievable people from, you know, best practice globally to come on board with everything from the marketing all the way to the product design. So launching that would be really exciting. And then on a personal level, I've got in the next kind of few months, I'm best man at two of my best mates' weddings.
Right.
So
so you've got to write writing a speech isn't going to be an issue, is it really?
Well, you know, I think, you know, there's always the added pressure of wanting to do a good job, you know, for them. But part of that actually is a really incredible thing. I'm quite passionate about, like, reshaping traditional bucks parties around, you know, the classic get as pissed as possible, let's embarrass the buck and get some strippers around, to actually creating a real meaningful rite of passage that can send our mates off into their marriage, have an unbelievable experience, but something that really sets them on the right trajectory. So with one of my mates, there's nine of us who are flying over to London, going to Amsterdam and then to Greece. And we've curated this whole unbelievable experience that will do hopefully exactly that for our mate who's getting
I was
going
to say, you just said no strippers and then he said Amsterdam and I'm like,
No. That's we're intentional around where we're going.
Right, but, okay. I'll trust you on that one there. But yeah, well, this, I was going to say, I'll give you my best man speech tip because I got to say this, and I know you've done a shitload more public speaking than I have. But one of the things I always find breaks the ice really well at the start of a best man speech is to do a big interactive quiz with the whole room about the bride and the groom. And you ask, and you have yourself a bottle of champagne as a prize or something like that. And you get everybody to stand up and you give them A or B answers and they have to move to the side of the room and blah, 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 blah. Always found that it's amazing how as soon as you interject a bit of, interaction and a bit of engagement with a speech like that, all of a sudden you get such a better return. And you must see that doing normal speeches as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's an amazing idea, by the way. And I'll definitely think about that. But a lot of my role is working with groups, you know, facilitating groups from, you know, 30 to 2,000 on stage. And, one of the things I'm passionate about is instead of just speaking at people, speaking with people and really working with what's in the room. Yeah. So, but that was a very good reminder to kind of get out of my head and get back into my heart for this speech.
Yeah. Last question. If people want to get hold of you, if they want to ask you a question, if they want you to speak at one of their events, what's the best way of getting in contact with you?
Beautiful. So on LinkedIn, Hunter Johnson is my name, just Hunter Johnson, the man cave, it should come up. I'm on Twitter at HunterJohnson91. The man cave web address is www.themancave.life. That's LIFE. Yep. And if you want to email us, hello@themancave.life awesome. Is the best point.
Perfect. Mate, thank you very much for your time. You're doing some amazing work out there and I hope many people get to see you up and speaking or one of your team doing a session. So good luck with everything for 2019 and thank you for being on the show.
Beautiful. Thanks for the opportunity, Simon.
That's pretty much it for episode 57. Thank you very much for tuning into the Paper Planes podcast. My name is Simon Dell. It has been fantastic having you along with us and we hope you can listen in next week. So remember, last thing, rate and review us on iTunes. We would most appreciate that. Thank you very much.